From the Three Story Method Podcast Network.
This is the Serial Fiction Show.
I'm Christine Daigle.
And I'm JP Reinbush.
Welcome to the Reader Serial Fiction Show. Today we've got a dystopian detective novel by M.H. Handelman called Ashland. 2 years ago, a swarm of self-replicating, flesh-eating microbots known as the Ash spread across the globe. 12% of humanity died in the first month. Everyone else sealed themselves inside. Now, to locate a missing scientist who may know how to end the machine plague, Detective Kai Braddock will have to do what no one's done since the outbreak began. He'll have to go outside. This dystopian detective novel is perfect for fans of Marcus Sakey, Andy Weir, and The Last Policeman.
M.H. Handelman is the pen name of Matt Harry, who has written the middle grade novels Sorcery for Beginners, Cryptozoology for Beginners, and Super Kid. Booklist called his work clever, often hilarious, and BuzzFeed agreed, it's a fun getaway for any age. Ashland is his first serialized novel for adults. Matt received an MFA in film production from USC's School of Cinematic Arts, and now has worked as a filmmaker, editor, screenwriter, college professor, movie critic, and story consultant. His writing has been published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Akron Beacon Journal, and the textbook The Elements of Style. Currently, he's doing a Kickstarter for a Choose Your Own Career Path book for adults. Part memoir, part novel, all fun. Live out your dreams in over 100 endings. The Kickstarter is linked in the show notes. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife and two sons, all of whom love to read. And now, a sample of Ashland, Episode 1.
"26 months, 8 days, 14 hours, 29 minutes since Ash outbreak. The 3rd Street Promenade was a boneyard. I'd expected the outdoor mall to be empty of people. Everything was these days. But I was surprised to see so many skeletons. Rat bones, bird bones, even the occasional remains of a dog or cat, with collars still encircling the sun-bleached vertebrae. All had been bulldozed into 10-foot-tall pyramids on the promenade. You don't notice how many animals there are in the world until their corpses are lying on the sidewalk. For each human living in Los Angeles, it was estimated that there were 40 to 50 times the amount of birds and 5 or 6 times the amount of rats, to say nothing of all the squirrels, deer, coyotes, and other meat-based creatures that walked, flew, slithered, and skittered across the city. Every one of them fell victim to the ash. Some places simply left the carcasses to rot. Others sent out remote-controlled burn units to reduce the critters to cinders. But the more upscale cities, concerned that the bodies were a bleak reminder of humanity's imprisonment, had bulldozed the animal remains and dumped them in a central, low-traffic location. In Santa Monica, evidently, that location had been the 3rd Street Promenade. Before the machine plague, the promenade had been a hub of human activity, an open-air, 4-block temple to consumerism, food, and entertainment. Now weeds sprouted through the concrete pavers. Metal grillwork, chewed up by ash and brown with rust, covered forgotten storefronts. Dry tumbleweeds of paper garbage collected in the empty fountains. It had only been 2 years since the popular tourist spot had closed, but it might as well have been 100. I swiveled my head to the right. The camera on the Triton V UAS dart drone that I was piloting followed my movement. The marquee of the AMC Broadway movie theater, backlit by the afternoon sun, filled the HUD display inside my VR visor. The boys and I had seen the last Marvel movie at this theater. No film titles were listed now. Instead, the marquee held a message some plucky employee had put up just before the stay-at-home order had gone into effect 2 years prior. Stay home. Stay safe. This too shall pass. I gave a humorless snort. Odds were the Pollyanna who had posted those last 4 words was ash food by now. And if they weren't, I hope they regretted the phrasing of their final sentiment to the world. It may have seemed upbeat at the time, but these days, the last sentence read like some kind of dark prophecy. for not only had the ash persisted for 768 days so far, but the purpose of the building beneath the marquee had passed on as well. People still watch movies, sure, but doing so in a theater filled with strangers was as dead as Charlie Chaplin. I nudged the stick of my controller forward. The drone I was piloting followed suit, buzzing past long empty restaurants and forgotten brand outlets at 30 miles per hour. The Triton V had great pickup. It was no wonder racers preferred these models. Less than 2 minutes later, I arrived at the archway entrance to the Santa Monica Pier. I brought the drone to a hover just before the iconic blue and white sign, its neon tube words still visible under a layer of squirming gray ash motes. Santa Monica Yacht Harbor, it read. Sport fishing, boating, cafes. Not anymore, I thought to myself. The tiny robots might look like dust to the naked eye, but viewed through a microscope, they were monsters. Each moat had the round, fanged mouth of a tube worm and the fat, segmented body of a termite. A tiny set of wings allowed them to fly on air currents, and simple solar cells eliminated the need for recharging. Worse, the machines could self-replicate, spitting out copies of themselves until a new source of protein was detected. They'd been developed to destroy virus proteins, but a programming error made them target muscle protein instead. That single typo had killed 12% of the population in 1 month and driven everyone else inside. As the world had seen countless times in the last 2 years, anyone who went outside could be consumed by a single handful of ash in under 5 minutes. Still, some people risked it. One such person stepped out from behind the pier's archway. He wore a thick polymer hazmat suit, glued together from secondhand models of various colors. The serial numbers had been filed off to avoid identification. The face shield sun visor was reflective, the better to throw off facial ID cameras, and the hard plastic helmet surrounding it was tough enough to take several direct hits from a crowbar. A body cam was attached to the figure's chest, and a cracked tablet computer was strapped to his left forearm. Several canisters of compressed air clicked in his polymer-frame backpack. The overall effect was like a Frankenstein's monster made out of personal protective gear. The man inside was a bit like a Frankenstein's monster, too. Even though I couldn't see him yet, I knew he was 6'5", broad-shouldered, and had a skull as thick as a bowling ball. He'd been a linebacker in high school, but when he didn't score a scholarship to college, he became a bouncer, both the legal and not-so-legal kind. He lifted a plastic-coated Smith & Wesson Model 6.86 revolver, pointing the barrel straight at my drone camera. "Pier's closed right now to sightseers," the man said in a muffled voice that was all gravel and tobacco juice. "You want to look at the ocean, hang a left toward Venice." I pressed a button to activate the drone's external speaker. "It's me, Tevin," I said into my headset microphone. My voice echoed slightly as the UAV broadcasted over the abandoned pier. Tevin kept the revolver up. "What's your call sign?" he asked suspiciously. I sighed but nudged the drone sideways so he could read the serial number on the side of the machine. "Delta Charlie 418," I told him. The figure lowered the pistol and raised his sun visor, revealing a broad, brown-skinned face split by a wide grin. "Shit, Kai, I was just messing with you. I ain't seen another drone since I got here. This place is Deadsville." "Ha ha ha, asshole. You know, if you put a round in one of my robo-babies, even accidentally, it's coming out of your pay." Tevin held up a hand of apology and holstered the Smith & Wesson on his hip. "Actually, I was beginning to worry you might not show, boss. Having issues with my West LA charging station. Damn drone keeps falling off the induction plate. Maybe you shouldn't let it drink so much then." "Wow, you are just on fire today." I pulled back on the vertical control stick, lifting my Triton V to about 20 feet off the ground. Down below us, the buildings and amusement park rides of the Santa Monica Pier stood empty. Tombstones to a time gone by. "How long has he been inside?" "About 30 minutes, Tevin replied. "He had one of them electric scooters you used to see everywhere before the outbreak, but it crapped out around 4th Street. He hoofed it the rest of the way to the carousel." I squeezed a button on my controller to zoom in on the carousel building. The windows were dark, draped in a veil of ash. "Did he look injured? Any damage to his suit?" "Negative. He did, however, bust down a window to get inside." He pointed toward the northwestern corner of the building. A lower window was smashed, gaping like a missing tooth in a row of pearly whites. If we're lucky, he tore his suit going in and he's bot chow by now. If he's dead, we lose the full bounty, I reminded him. I'd been tracking this particular criminal for 2 months now, but the perp had refused to come up for air. Then a few hours ago, I'd received a text from an anonymous tipster with a 310 area code. They'd spotted someone fixing a generator on an efficiency unit near Pico and 17th. This was unusual to begin with. Almost all maintenance work these days was performed by remote-controlled drones. But weirder still, the tipster insisted that the Jenny worker looked exactly like notorious murderer Daniel Guyen. They hadn't attached a photo, but it was the best lead I'd had in weeks. I'd immediately contacted Tevin Hall. He was my best surrogate, a freelance investigator and full-time scrapper. In the 6 months I'd been a private investigator, I'd hired Tevin to perform courier runs, sit on houses, and collect evidence. Tasks that couldn't be easily completed via drone. It helped having someone on the payroll who was unafraid to go outside, even if he was associated with a notorious gang. Tevin had texted back immediately, "You want a door knock or a stakeout with this one?" He added a smiley emoji and $4 signs at the end. "Door knock," I'd replied. "We need the positive ID, but for $3 signs. Can you get there ASAP?" "No sweat. I've got Tetsuo." This was his pet name for his refurbished Honda scooter. Tevin had it covered in plastic panels he'd scavenged from abandoned construction sites. He'd also removed the motor's governor so he'd get the little vehicle up to 90 miles an hour if need be. I kept meaning to ask him whether his name for it was a reference to the anime film Akira or the 1989 Japanese horror film. "See you shortly," I'd responded. Unfortunately, my rendezvous with Tevin had taken longer than expected. I had 3 UAVs stashed at charging stations around the city, but when I'd realized the one in West LA had been knocked off its induction plate, I'd had to take out the one I had charged in Studio City instead. Even with the ability to fly straight over the Hollywood Hills and beeline straight for the ocean, 25 minutes had passed before I was able to reach Santa Monica. By then, Tevin had knocked on the door of the efficiency container. Instead of answering, Guyen had climbed out of the bathroom window and hopped on an electric scooter, forcing my surrogate to give chase. He'd followed our bounty all the way to the Santa Monica Pier, where the perp was now cowering in the carousel building like a spooked bunny rabbit. "Caught up to him at 4th and Broadway," Tevin told me. "Think he was planning to hole up in the Williams-Sonoma. But once he saw me on his ass, he lit out for the pier. I managed to grab a still off my body cam when he started shooting at me." He tapped his wrist tablet, airdropping a JPEG to my drone. I opened it on my heads-up display. It was zoomed in, pixelated, but there was no doubt it was Daniel Guyen. Beneath the plastic helmet were the same pockmarked cheeks, receding hairline, and weaselly eyes I'd been staring at for weeks. His hand clutched a polymer-coated Beretta M9. My pulse quickened. "This is it," I told myself. "Today you catch the murdering bastard."
So, Death by Dust Bunnies is an excellent way to introduce this self-replicating, flesh-eating, unstoppable force. And I just loved the imagery that you put right off the bat of piles of bones from animals and the detail. I hadn't really thought about or seen that in post-apoc fiction. So I'm just kind of curious. I know partly what inspired this, but I'm curious what ultimately inspired you to write this?
I mean, it's probably going to be a pretty obvious answer. Thank you for saying you like the description too. I was inspired by the pandemic, basically. About in March of 2020, when we all started to shut down and everything closed down, I was walking around my neighborhood and just everybody was inside and the streets were empty at rush hour. And it was really a freaky time. We didn't know, you know, could you get it from things you touched? Could you get it from seeing people? Did masks work? We didn't know any of that stuff. And so it was really scary. And I think I dealt with that by asking, how could this be worse? Somehow that was therapeutic for me. I don't know if that's how my brain goes. So I kind of started imagining, well, what if we went inside and couldn't come out? Because at least, you know, we all had to stay in our own houses and work from home, but at least we go on walks and things. And that was actually one of the, and go on drives. Like that was how I got out of the house, is I would take my son out, who was five at the time, every day in the afternoon, hoping he would get a nap. And I would drive to different areas of the city, which were completely empty because everyone was inside. And I would just sit in my car in the shade and I would try and write, and he would sit in the back and hopefully sleep for a couple hours. And then as the summer went on and I continued writing, he took less naps. And so I would tell him to do his work, but he'd be like, how many more minutes? How many more minutes? So it was like having a gun to my head as I was writing these chapters. But so it was really inspired by the pandemic, this idea of, you know, what would it be like? What would the world look like if we were totally trapped inside and couldn't go out? And one of the things that was surprised me about the pandemic was how quickly and easily we adjusted to all that. Like how so many jobs moved online and how so much we could do online, and we're getting our groceries delivered. And I live in Los Angeles, so we have little drone delivery bots that you see in like Hollywood sometimes. Like they're like little tanks that deliver people's Uber Eats and stuff. So I was like, we're not that far from this. The question then became, what would keep them inside? What sort of thing could exist that would be that deadly, that would be everywhere, that they would be, you know, you could only go outside in a really scary hazmat suit, and even a lot of people wouldn't even choose to do that because of the danger. And so that became a lot trickier to figure out.
So under your other author name, you write for a younger audience. How has writing in the dystopian and post-apoc genre been different for you?
Such a relief. actually, it's funny. I've always done a lot of different genres. I actually think it was one of the things that kind of hampered me a bit when I was starting off as a writer, because I started writing when I was very, very young, when I was about 10 years old. I wrote my first novel when I was in seventh grade. It had the very terrible title of The Great Girl Chase. And that was where my head was, I guess. And it was awful, and nothing ever happened with it. And as I started getting older, I got into movies and I realized people could write movies. And I was like, oh my God, I'm definitely going to go do that. And so I went to film school. I wrote screenplays, and it was like every screenplay I wrote would be a different genre from the one before it. So like my first one was like an assassin drama, and my second one was like a weird fantasy thing. And then my third one was actually a dystopian bomb shelter script about like a murder mystery happens inside a bomb shelter and they have to figure out who did it. And so it was always something I've really been interested in. And then just over the years, I kind of realized my particular voice was a little bit more geared towards comedy. And so I had this idea for a story called Sorcery for Beginners, and all the way back in 2012. And I pitched it to my agent at the time, my screenwriting agent. And he was like, I love the story, but nobody's going to buy this. Like, nobody's buying spec screenplays anymore. He's like, if you told me this is based on a book, I'd say great, but it's not based on a book. So I was driving home and I was super upset. And I said, well, you know what? I'm just going to write a book then. Cut to 4 years later, and because I hadn't written a book since, you know, I was in seventh grade. And I would sit down and I was like, oh my God, there's so many words. You know, because I was writing screenplays, which are like 120 pages. There's a lot of white space. And suddenly it was like 2 pages a day was like a good day. It just took forever. And then halfway through that book, I realized, because it's about a kid who finds like a help guide to magic, like a for dummies guide to magic. And I realized, well, maybe this book should actually be like a help guide, after I'd done 2 drafts of the actual story. And so then I started restructuring it and putting these little side details and things. And then I sent that around, and I got a lot of interest from agents, but then various things happened. And then I had it up on this indie publisher site called Inkshares. And I got a call from the publisher one day, and he had told me that, weirdly, like a movie producer had seen the summary. And he was like, who is this? Are you publishing this book? And all I'd done is like put a chapter on this, you know, site, which is all you could do. And the publisher was like, we got to publish this book. And I was like, who are you? But he really kept at it. Like, he kind of chased me for like 6 months and, you know, would call me every weekend and be like, I'm reading your book. It's great. We got to do this. And so I finally ended up publishing my book with them. And that book ended up getting optioned to be turned into a TV show, which I was hired to write. So it kind of came full circle in a weird way, like 8 years after I kind of pitched my agent this idea, I actually turned in the pilot for the TV show, which unfortunately I turned in February of 2020, which was the worst time to go to a producer and say, hey, you want to make a TV show? So I don't know what's happening with that at this point. Probably not much, but it was kind of like a terrible time to turn that in, unfortunately. So then I was like, what am I going to do now? You know, nobody's making anything. And I had this idea as I was walking around these empty, you know, streets of Los Angeles, like, you know, this, what if we never came out? What if we went inside and never came out? What would that be like? And that went through a lot of iterations before I ended up on the final thing. The first thing was kind of like, what if there's like a delivery guy who goes outside and he meets somebody and falls in love? And I was like, I don't know if I want to do like a love story. And then I thought about like, you know, a soldier of some kind. And I was like, that wasn't really up my alley either. And then I hit upon the idea of like a detective story. Like if you had to investigate something and you had to do it in this world where you couldn't go outside, you couldn't talk to people in person, you know, you're only interacting through drones and Zooms. It's like, that would make your job much more difficult. You can't trust what people are telling you. You can't look in their eyes. You can't physically get evidence. And so once I kind of was on that, I was like, oh, this would be really cool. So I get to go back to like that dystopian idea that I'd early had. And I even grabbed some ideas from that earlier script of mine, because I always love this idea of people in air suits kind of outside. There's something really weird and eerie about that to me. Like the world looking kind of normal, like you said, just looks like dust bunnies, but it can kill you.
Yeah, that's such a fun origin story of, well, if no one writes this book, I'm going to write it myself. And then
I recommend that to all writers.
It's a wonderful, wonderful idea for all writers. I'm curious for this series, do you have everything planned out, or will audience participation play a role where the story goes?
That's a great question. I hadn't written this to be a serialized Vella novel. I was just kind of writing it, you know, to be a classic standard novel. And then when I saw the, you know, Kindle Vella was happening, I thought, oh, that might be an interesting way, because I had a really big question as I was working on it, which was like, I was interested in this, but I was like, is anyone else going to want to read this right now or ever? You know, like, because obviously it's makes you think of the pandemic. I mean, like on the first page, I was literally pulling in things that I was seeing, like signage outside movie theaters and things like, stay safe, you know, we'll see you in the future. Like I'd drive past the Hollywood Bowl and it'd be like, keep playing music, Los Angeles. And it was like so heartbreaking, you know, all these venues that were kind of abandoned and shuttered. And I was like, I don't know if people are going to like this at all. So I thought Vella would be a great way to kind of test those waters and see if people responded to that. And one of the things I ran into first was I'd written kind of pretty long chapters, and you know, Vella has the $5,000 word limit. I wish it was $5,000 an episode. That'd be amazing. 5,000 word limit. And so I had to break up my chapters into kind of smaller chunks. And then I also realized I was putting them on there that, I need to really like end on a cliffhanger. You know, not all my chapters necessarily were like the most cliffhanger-y type ending. So that made me do some adjustments as I was posting them as well. So this novel I didn't write for Vella. I kind of adapted it to the format once it came out. But I have ideas for two sequels, and I think that would be interesting. And I'd love to get feedback. I haven't really seen, I guess people could reach out like through the websites and stuff. I would love it if there was like a comment. You know, I guess that people can leave reviews and stuff, but it's not like, it'd be so cool if like on each episode you could leave comments and people could say like, oh, is this going to happen? Because I would love to have that experience.
Yeah, I think that's something all authors are kind of hoping will be a future addition to the Vella site for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was good for me definitely to have the book complete because I knew it had an ending. I knew where it was going. I've read through it multiple times. You know, because I had basically prepped it for publication, traditional publication. So I'd gone through it. And I think that was really good. I think it would be definitely a little bit more stressful if I was writing it as I was going. Particularly, I think right now, because it's like, I've been seeing a lot of people reading the first three chapters, which are free, and then there's a huge drop off. So if I was on chapter five and like no one was reading chapter four, I'd probably be like, oh, screw this, you know. I'd probably stop. So yeah, but it'd be interesting to do, like, if there is an audience for it, I would love to do that with like the second or third book. And literally do, it's funny because I have a choose your adventure book, like an adult choose your adventure book that I'm doing a Kickstarter for in the end of September called You Are a Filmmaker. And so I love that format and I would love to kind of do that. Like, what do you guys want to do next? Do you want to go in this direction or this direction? I think that'd be a super fun way to write a book.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked about considering bacteria thawing from Antarctica as a possible threat before deciding on gray goo. What kind of research went into crafting this world?
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned that earlier. Once I kind of started with the world first, which I don't often do when I write stories. I've much more likely started with like a character or like a premise, you know, some kind of something that'll spin out a plot. And this was much more like the world idea I started with. So I kind of had to reverse engineer it in a way. And the first thing I did was I reached out to some, because I love science, but I'm not a scientist at all. And so I have to give a shout out to my cousin-in-law, Sharmila, because she actually is an infectious disease scientist. She was actually working in Washington, D.C. with COVID patients at the beginning of COVID. And she actually got COVID early on because she was in like the early, you know, doctors working with people who had COVID. Nobody knew what was happening and studying it. She didn't get very sick, thankfully. She had one of the more milder cases, but she had, you know, had to quarantine from her family and stuff. So I called her up late in the summer, and I was like, once I'd kind of gotten the first draft, and I was like, here's what I want to do. Like, is there something that exists in science like that? And we talked about viruses first and how, you know, viruses mutate. But the thing about a virus is, like, if you don't give it anything to feed, it will die out. And like we've talked about that with COVID. They've basically said if everyone in the world went inside for 4 weeks, this would be gone. But obviously that's a huge ask, right, to do. And so obviously that couldn't work because I wanted them to be a couple years into this. And then she brought up bacteria and suggested the idea of, like, you know, Antarctic bacteria, which were like defrosting and we'd never seen before, because bacteria can live a long, long time outside. And I thought that was interesting. But then I also thought, well, you could like carpet bomb cities and stuff and like kind of set up fire breaks. And I feel like you could kind of establish it. So I needed something that was a little bit smarter and a little bit more, you know, kind of programmable and self-replicating. And so then that's when I got to the idea of gray goo, which is a classic, you know, sci-fi concept and has been done in a couple of things. Like I think Michael Crichton did a book called Prey that kind of got into that a little bit. But I hadn't seen it in terms of, you know, this kind of execution. So that was kind of exciting for me to do. And so then I reached out to a friend of mine who knew a robotics guy, and I talked to him, and we had a great conversation about, like, well, how could these machines exist and how would they self-replicate and what would they be able to do to have to build like a solar cell? And, you know, found out that it's actually kind of simple for some of these technologies to exist. Like, you can build a solar cell in your garage with basic stuff if you need to, or a circuit. So that's where I kind of settled on that idea.
You said in your author notes that you got into crafting cocktails during COVID. What signature drink would you complement well with reading Ashland, or will you be making a mixology for the Apocalypse Companion Guide?
Oh my God, that's a great idea. I got a great book that I started using. And in terms of cocktails, one of the reasons I like cocktails is I tend towards having a sweet tooth, and I don't necessarily like straight hard liquors personally. And like even beer is a little like bitter for me. I much prefer wine and stuff. And so cocktails to me are a great way to like take something like I wouldn't normally drink, like whiskey or gin straight, and make it into something delicious. So I had these two great cocktail guides that I used. And one was like a tiki cocktail guide that my brother-in-law got me. And I did a lot of those. Those are super fun because they're citrusy and they're sweet and they use, you know, coconut and rum and all things I like. And then I used this other one from like a, I have to go check the title of it. I have to go grab it and check the title. But that was like more of a classic cocktail book that, you know, you could do Manhattans and martinis and things like that. So I wanted the main character in this, like, cause he's like, it's kind of a spin on the classic film noir detective. But since he's in a dystopia, I was like, this guy's not going to be drinking whiskey. Like, you don't need smoky liquor on top of like the dystopia. I think you want like sweet stuff. And that's what I found for myself in the pandemic. Like, I eat my feelings basically. So, you know, I'd see something about like 4,000 more cases in LA and I'd be like, I'm getting a donut. Like, it was just like immediate. Like, where's the ice cream? I'm making a cocktail. And so I got into doing that every day. And so I was like, I think it'd be fun if this guy was drinking like super sweet stuff, like mojitos. And so definitely the mojito is the signature cocktail of my main character of Kai Braddock and probably the signature drink of the book. And what I like about it is it's super tasty and you can make it with like almost nothing. It doesn't require a lot of like bitters and, you know, all these extra things that you need to have on hand. You just need simple syrup, lime juice, rum, and bubbly water, and mint. And it's all stuff you could grow in like your little tiny kitchenette if you needed to. And so that would definitely be the signature cocktail. I love the idea of a cocktail guide though. That's awesome. Like each chapter, like which character would drink what? Because there is a chapter later on where he meets Walter Wrigley, who's like the CEO of this big company. And they have like Macallan, you know, 54 scotch, and they just drink it neat. So that's definitely a great idea.
I love that. I'm in for the mojito as long as I don't have to use a brown lime.
I know. I've definitely been in that position, especially during the pandemic. I was like, damn it. I only got 5 limes and I'm like, done. So I'm like cutting the limes into smaller and smaller wedges to try and use them in cocktails.
Oh, that's funny. So I love the nostalgia in this piece with the carousel and the arcade games like Centipede and Joust, which was the most ridiculous game ever, but I loved playing it. What are your favorite pieces of nostalgia in the serial?
Well, you mentioned a few right there. I purposely, so there's a big set piece in the first chapter where they go to the Santa Monica Pier and it's totally abandoned. And if you've ever been out in LA, like the Santa Monica Pier is never abandoned. Like there's always people, even if you're like, I was going home once at 2 a.m. from a bar and I walked past it and there was tons of people on the pier, you know, because the bars let out and everyone goes there to make out and, you know, look at the ocean and stuff. And so I thought that was kind of a cool thing, you know, the idea of looking at this kind of amusement area that's such a famous tourist spot and having it be kind of empty and rusty and crumbling because the ash has eaten through everything. And then there happens to be an arcade right there and the carousel. So I definitely, all the games I threw in are like some of my favorite games, like the Star Wars original trilogy arcade pod is like the best. And I took my kids to an arcade right before they went back to school. And I'm the one who's like, we're going over to Star Wars, guys. And they're like, oh, great, this will be fun. I'm like, get out of the way. Like, I'm playing. And I put the quarters in. And then I wanted to, and as I was thinking about those games, I realized so many of them are apocalypse games, like end of the world, everything's collapsing, and they're all shooting games. They're all like, I'm just going to go shoot the crap out of everything, and everything's going to be fine. Oh, there's an oil drum, kaboom. And what I liked about this, you know, if you can even call it an antagonist, the situation is you can't do that. You can't reason with it. You can't shoot the thing. You could drop a nuclear bomb on a whole city and it's like, fine, you got that. But guess what? It's over here and it replicated, like it'll be there. And so I loved that idea of kind of using those games as a jumping off point for this philosophical idea of this thing that you really can't kill with like physical violence.
Is there anything you haven't explored yet that you plan to or want to with this serial?
Well, it definitely goes to some fun places in Los Angeles. I really tried to, I've lived in LA for 20 years and I really kind of consider it my home now. It's the place I've lived longest. And so I really tried to look at a lot of different aspects of Los Angeles from different perspectives. Like in chapter 4, he goes to the Hollywood Bowl and later on he goes to the Griffith Observatory and he goes to even Santa Barbara. there's a scene out in one of the Channel Islands at Santa Barbara later on in downtown Los Angeles. And he's walking past all these landmarks. And so I really felt like I wanted to explore a lot of Los Angeles. And then I have, you know, for the story kind of as a series, I really want to go to New York City for the second book. And the idea I had is that I think New York City is going to be domed. Like, it's small enough that I think they, and there were 2 years into this, that they were able to build kind of a bubble, you know, like almost a greenhouse bubble over most of Manhattan. And some of the skyscrapers are going to stick out the top, you know, but I love that idea of like, they can live inside this dome bubble in the city. And that's, what's that like? What's that society like? Like, how much would that real estate be worth to be able to walk around without an air suit? And then I also have an idea for the third book of like going out to Hawaii, because Kai's dad, it doesn't really get mentioned in this book, but Kai's dad is like a Navy general who lives on the, you know, the base in Honolulu. And so he needs to go out and deal with his dad. And I had the idea of like underwater cities that they start making in Hawaii, like, you know, going, cause the ash can't get under the water. That's kind of the one thing. So they've started moving like off the island and underwater and like digging beneath the island to live under there. And so, and then I even had ideas for like little one-offs that I thought, oh, it might be cool to like do short stories where it'd just be interesting to see different perspectives, how different people dealt with this. Like, I had an idea for a story about, you know, a biologist who goes to watch the last ever salmon spawning because the ash is coming and he knows once they get to a certain place, like all those fish kind of jumping through the water are going to get eaten up by the ash. So, you know, she goes to watch the last salmon spawning and, you know, I thought that'd be a cool idea. I had an idea of like kids going outside to do like a snipe hunt outside, but like a really scary game of hide and seek where they get outside and the ash is coming and the kid has to get back in. So I feel like there's a lot of ways to kind of take it in this world. Like, it'd be interesting to do a love story set in this world where people, they fall in love over Zoom and they can't connect, and how do they connect with each other? So yeah, I have a lot of ideas. It'd be really great to explore the world and go to different areas of the world and see how they dealt with it.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Definitely looking forward to Escape from New York in reverse.
Totally. Escape in New York. Right now I'm calling it City Under Glass, but I like that title, Escape to New York. We get the John Carpenter score.
Fantastic. So one last question. What do you like most about writing serial fiction?
I feel like I tend to write in a serial type style anyway. I really like reading books that have that kind of cliffhangery, edge of your seat, like constant, things are constantly twisting and happening. And so I think that's a natural kind of fit for me. And like I said, I kind of had to adapt the book a little bit to fit the serial format, like really end on cliffhangers and things. But I like that kind of storytelling. I will sometimes read books. They tend to be literary books, but I've seen it with genre books too, where it's like, I'll get to the end of a chapter and it'll be like, okay, like nothing, like what now? Like, why do I want to keep reading? And I don't know about you guys, but I have like always a dozen books on my bedside table. And so there's this one book, I don't name it, but I thought the concept was super cool, but it was like each chapter was like, this is so like, it's just not going anywhere. And for me, what's great about having that serial format is it really does feel like an episode of television where it's like, what's our problem? What are we doing to try and solve it? Something unexpected happens. Now we've got a new problem and we're into the next episode. And I just love that kind of storytelling. I love it in books. I love it in TV. I love it in plays when I can kind of be kept on the edge of my seat and want to keep reading. That to me is such a great experience when you're just reading something and you're like, that's what you choose to do, is I got to keep reading this book. You know, because there's so many options for entertainment. And I used to be like a finisher, and there's just so much now. I'm like, if it doesn't hold my attention, I'm like, it was such a relief to me when like, it happened when I had kids too. That's a big part of it. But being able to say, you know what? I don't need to finish this. I got it. Like with a show, whatever. And it just frees you up to go find something better. So that's so great when you can find something. So that's what I aspire to, is to write that kind of thing that hopefully you want to keep reading and stick with to the very end.
Definitely. Well, we're loving this series, and we can't wait for more to come out. So
great.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're dropping 3 episodes a week. So, and it'll probably go up until September. It was quite a long book. It was like, I think it's like 34, 35 chapters, episodes total. So
excellent.
About halfway through right now.
Well, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Our thanks today to M.H. Handelman for letting us share their episode. If you liked it, you can read the first 3 episodes free on Kindle Vella. The link is in the show notes. Also, if you're a writer, we have a companion podcast, The Writer's Serial Fiction Show, where we talk with authors about their stories and discuss the elements of writing compelling serial fiction.
We want to thank you for listening to The Writer's Serial Fiction Show. If you know someone who might enjoy the show, send them your favorite episode link. And if you want to leave an Apple Podcast review, we read all of them and take your suggestions. You can also leave a comment on this episode on our website, serialfictionshow.com. Finally, we now have a Patreon where you can get Serial Fiction Show episodes early and other great stuff. We have tons of things in the works. Check it out at patreon.com/serialfictionshow. Thanks, and we'll see you next time with another serial fiction episode.
And that's a wrap.
Am I saying this last part? Lint liquor. That from? Isn't that a commercial?
It is.
What, the French toast? Is it that one? Is it that one?
It is that one. Because they like are trying to swear, but they're just saying everything. You lint liquor.